The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Hello, strangers. It's time for another Flat Chat. The latest edition of GP Racing magazine is on the newsstands as we look at how McLaren went from also-ran to Red Bull beta. Hey, it's so topical, it's as if we even planned it. You may have got the impression that something's been missing from your life for the past month or so. And you're not wrong. We've had a podcasting interregnum owing to various parties of the first part being away on holiday, or even having the wretched temerity to be working or travelling with work. Fortunately, we are back with our original cast. It's not like when Airwolf disappeared from the world's TV screens for a year and then came back with Barry Van Dyke flying the titular chopper rather than Jan Michael Vincent. Let's introduce our guests. Unlike Jan Michael Vincent, he's never murdered a cat. It's Alex Kalinorkas.
Certainly not, Connors, no. But I do have to commend you for your use of one of my favourite words, interregnum. As a keen student of history, I approve of that. But also, when one uses it, I also enjoy, and this probably makes me sound like a terrible snob, but whatever, I'm going with it. Just the slight look of confusion on some people's faces where they wonder if you're either saying something about pregnancy or some horrible orifice on your body. It's one of the two. That's what the word sounds like. But anyway.
Oh, I need my interregnum probed.
Exactly.
Sounds like the sort of thing that used to happen in appalling cheap science fiction films in the 1970s. Now, casting our net further afield, do I hear the distinct sounds of the Captain Pugwash theme? Because he's on his boat. Unlike Jan Michael Vincent, he's never required an emergency tracheotomy after wrapping his car around a telegraph pole during a drink and drug binge. It's Mark Gallagher.
I'm very pleased that that has never happened to me, and I don't plan to start now, I can tell you. Thank you very much. Great to have the chance to natter with you again after, as you say, that little break that we had in August. It's not that we're short, not like we are short of things to talk about in Formula One at the moment. So looking forward to the next 60 minutes or so with you and Alex.
Indeed. Well, let's crack on. And now, because of all this documentation of the Jan Michael Vincent's history might have set our producers' teeth on edge. Don't worry, Dre, he's been dead 5 years. You can't sue. Now, with a monthly magazine, you have to plan well in advance. Some people think we just throw GP Racing together the day before it closes for press. No. And on top of that, there's the lag between sending it to print and it appearing on the shelves. So you need to tread carefully to avoid events making you look stupid, as I believe Harold Macmillan might have said to someone once. With that in mind, we've been thinking about a McLaren cover since around about April. But even after McLaren brought the Miami upgrade package and Lando won their ancient history now, I know, we still had a few misgivings. What if it proved to be an outlier, some form of flash in the pan, track specific, something like that? So we delayed it from the August issue to the September issue, which happily enabled us to arrange an exclusive interview with team principal Andrea Stella. Obviously, McLaren had evolved their car to a point where it could win races last year, but stringing race wins together into a championship bid is another matter, and we wanted to drill down into whether the championship was now possible. It's kind of looking like the Constructors' Championship is on. Question is the Drivers' Championship still on? Well, let's dig into that, Alex. You've written at length on Autosport about how McLaren's failure to control its drivers led to Charles Leclerc winning the race. That and a little bit of Leclerc's own brilliance. So what's your take?
A lot of Leclerc's own brilliance, I would say, Collins. But it's interesting. I think there was a certain amount of bittersweet weirdness about me seeing the cover feature of the latest edition of GP Racing magazine, because I was supposed to have written it. Now, this is getting a little bit inside baseball, a little bit like how the sausage is made, whatever you want to call the cliche. But basically, I was down to write this feature. But obviously, in my day job for Autosport and being an Autosport columnist after the British Grand Prix, I pretty much lambasted McLaren for blowing a 1-2, which they did do. But I also sort of listed the many mistakes that they made over the course of the year. Well, mainly from Miami onwards, the wins that they'd missed effectively, and Andrea Stella objected to that. Now, as is his wont, but actually we've spoken since and we've made up and we're all friends again now, although, you know, as you say, Goddard, I have been writing about them blowing a race win again, so we'll see how long that holds. But he's a very reasonable man and a very intelligent man, Andrea Stella. And actually what he was annoyed about was that there was one particular element that I'd listed all these wins that I thought they got away from them. One in particular was the Monaco Grand Prix, that Oscar Piastri, if he'd nailed all his sectors on when it really mattered at the end of qualifying, might have beaten Charles Leclerc to pole position and therefore effectively guaranteed a race victory. Stella says, this is just, no, absolutely not. I spoke to a few press room colleagues, you know, our former colleague Ed Straw was like, well, it did show the time was there. But Stella's absolutely adamant and also felt it was a little bit disrespectful to Leclerc. So happy to correct the record there. Not a missed opportunity for McLaren. But yeah, just a bit of a shame we didn't get to do the feature. But we got instead the BBC's F1 correspondent, Andrew Benson, to do the feature instead. And he did an excellent job. And actually, having alluded to our little falling out and making up again, I thought Andrea Stella came across very well. He did get in a little dig at the media and the topic of the mistakes. But no, he just sort of... What really comes across in the piece is just how detailed... he approaches everything, you know, coming with notes, explaining, you know, how you go from being just merely a good Formula One team to a great one. I just thought that came across tremendously well. And actually, although Monza didn't go to plan, specifically, I think, because of Oscar Piastri's decision making, McLaren have, ever since the summer break, have looked pretty slick. You know, I think the mistake with Monza was not backing Lando Norris earlier. And I think if they do end up losing this driver's title, which I think is on, not an easy thing to achieve, but it's possible given how far off the pace Red Bull appears to be, considering it was so far behind at Monza where it should have either won or been in contention. I think, you know, McLaren will look back on this period and think, oh, if we'd just gone harder, we might have been able to clinch both championships. That said, there's all this furore about flexi wings and what's going on there with the McLaren front wing, the Mercedes front wing. But yeah, it's all looking good for McLaren. If they can just solve this driver problem, which I know is something in particular, the team orders topic is another thing that really makes Andrea Stella irate. So yeah, let's see how we're getting on in Baku next time out.
Yeah, fantastic. I'm glad you mentioned that point in the feature where Andrew mentions Andrea being so well prepared, you know, coming armed with his facts and figures and any potential questions that are likely to be put to him. It is remarkable to see an engineer of Andrea Stella's caliber step up so well to this role of team principal. Not every engineer makes that transition easily. I think it's a pretty well understood fact that a lot of engineers don't enjoy management. They must prefer to be dealing with the minutiae that they've trained their brains to deal with and calculate in terms of engineering. And all of a sudden you get promoted and promoted and promoted and then end up sitting on top of the pile with a great many beat people reporting to you. And McLaren, of course, we've talked about it many times in this podcast, been through really quite a difficult period in the company's history over the last, decade and a half. You'd have to say the last 15 years have not been an easy ride for everyone there. And Andrea's approach, you know, that calm level-headedness and that attention to detail that he has is extraordinary. And there's an interesting juxtaposition between him and Zac Brown. You know, I find very different personalities, different backgrounds. You know, in many respects, I love the fact that we've almost got that kind of sort of duopoly at the top of McLaren that reminds you of the days when Formula One teams just had a technical boss and had a commercial boss, somebody who did the deals and somebody who, you know, called the shots technically. And it should have, I know he's team principal, but it sort of strikes me that, you know, in another era, they might have slightly different titles, but they both have such great strengths, having lined up that great portfolio of partners and sponsors who funding McLaren's success and the way that Andrea has taken that. And actually talking, listening to you talk, Alex, one of the things I've been thinking about in recent months is it's almost... has McLaren's surge caught them by surprise to the extent that they didn't really fully expect to be in the white heat of championship battling, midway through 2024 for both championships? And I agree with you wholeheartedly, you know, both are on. And we've all kind of sat and watched as they suddenly looked a tad indecisive at times and not really sure what to do with this. It's almost like they have an embarrassment of riches and they don't know which way to turn. I mean, we have all known, haven't we? And I suspect it's no surprise to Andrea Stella or Zak Brown, you know, that they have two cracking drivers. Neither of them is there to be number two. And if you're managed by Mark Webber, you know you've got a manager who's whispering in your ear every minute of the day, never let your teammate pass. Never let them overtake you. Ignore the team orders. You know, I mean, I'm sure it's not quite like that, but you know, you can just imagine the hunger that Oscar Piastri has to make the most of this opportunity to not just prove himself against Lando Norris. That's in itself not really enough. I mean, he wants to be the best in the world at what he does, and you know, watching Monza at the weekend, and it's just incredible to see, you know, what's unfolding. And it doesn't really matter what the leadership of McLaren are saying, there's a feeling, there has to be a view that they didn't really see this problem until it was right in front of them and don't quite know how to deal with it. I've been, you know, frankly appalled that Lando wasn't given just a clear run at the title with very clear team instructions to Oscar, not because of number one and number two status, but because of mathematics, because of who's more likely to win the championship from the points position. It's all about the points. And when you have a points deficit between your two drivers, no matter how much you love both of them or how much you want to play fair and all of this kind of thing, you have to be really careful not to simply hand the competitive advantage back to your rivals because you're being a bit indecisive or you don't want to have difficult conversations or upset someone. So it's going to be really interesting to see what comes out in the wash later on this year. I kind of feel like McLaren are probably coming a little bit late to the party in terms of realizing you absolutely have to give one guy everything you possibly can in order to win that driver's championship. And payday back to the teammate can come in another season and at another time. But this is a brutal business and you just can't take any prisoners.
Mark, you'd be astonished just how often Mark Webber's name came up after that race in Monza. Obviously, he's not spoken and unlikely to speak on what he's whispering into Oscar Piastri's ear, but we know exactly what his position will be. He knew exactly what, you know, it feels like to be made the number two driver sort of by default. So it's completely logical and plausible. But yeah, that pass at the second chicane had... Look, I'm making a point here. I'm not going to lie down and just take this. And I just thought that was very interesting.
It was welcome to jail, that, wasn't it? What, Alex is making a reference going overhead gesture. You've never seen Scum, have you?
Certainly haven't. No. Don't think I want to. By the sounds of it.
Well, anyway,
it was. You need to provide more editorial notes to go along with the podcast.
Sorry, that was just a reference off the top of my
references.
Head.
Footnotes for the
dear, oh dear. And the listener needs some notes as well. I should put them in. Yeah. It was forceful, verging on impolite, but it was very much a statement of intent, wasn't it, that manoeuvre? And also, I thought, to an extent, not great for McLaren, but great for the spectacle, the Netflix producers no doubt salivating. It gets people talking and it engages the interest of the media. And what do you know, that evening, the next day, Formula One was way, way, way higher up the news bulletins than, certainly the sporting element of the news bulletins, than it might otherwise have done, especially, you know, with the Paralympics in full flow and Britain at least having a very successful day at the Paralympics. So that you'd have expected would have cleared the schedule for the news bulletin. Even so, Formula One getting in there for a non-Brit winning the race. So pretty interesting from that perspective. In terms of McLaren, I was interested, Mark, in your choice of the word appalled. That makes a lot of sense. Do you think that, to an extent, Formula One away from Red Bull has become too nice? You know, you see certainly on social media the teams giving it, talking about wholesome feels, this hits different, everyone's being all cute and cuddly, and No one's really sort of showing that killer instinct when the time comes. Or people are as appalled as you, at drivers actually doing what racing drivers do, which is cutting each other up and being utterly ruthless.
But this is the thing. I mean, they're racing drivers who are supposed to want to do everything they can to win. And I was about to say within the rules, but then if we cast our mind back to certain multiple world champions who were very happy to sometimes overstep the rules, you know, Michael Schumacher and Ayrton Senna took no prisoners. They particularly were determined to destroy their teammate. I love the fact that on a recent podcast, Ralf Schumacher admitted that he never talked to any of his teammates ever during his career. He said, why would I? He said, they're not there to be my mate. I'm there to beat them. And actually, they're my biggest rival. And I think you've actually touched on something there, which, gosh, I could really go off on a tangent here. But, you know, amongst all this, tidal wave of social media PR and content that the Formula One teams indulge in, you know, I watch all the drivers being best mates with each other. And I think, you know, in the sporting sense, and I stress in the sporting sense, they need to be killing each other. I mean, there's no, there should be no quarter given. And, you know, I as you know, colleagues particularly, Alex, you may be aware of this, but I do a lot of work with ex-drivers, including David Coulthard, who was my first driver that I, you know, started working with in my company 12 years ago. And, I mean, I've worked with David so much over the years, and to finally hear him say in public on Channel 4 that given his time again, he would never have let Mika Häkkinen pass. You know, he would never have done it. If he had realized, you know, if he knew then what he knows now, he said, you know, you think you're keeping people happy by moving over to let your teammate pass, and you're thinking about, oh, well, I might get fired. I might get fired if I don't. And he said, of course, the truth is you won't get fired. And by the way, if you win the race, everybody will have, at worst, they'll have grudging admiration for the fact that you told everyone to go screw themselves. And you just win the race, because the only thing that anyone remembers is the win. And as David said on Channel 4, a win's a win. I mean, that's all that's there. And, I don't know Lando Norris. I don't know Oscar Piastri. You guys will have spent time with them, you know. But just so therefore, as a complete observer of all of this, it looks to me like Oscar has a greater killer instinct. And that's coming through. And Lando needs to be absolutely ruthless. That guy is not coming past me ever again. And by the way, if it takes a collision, I mean, and by the way, and this is, you know, this is me saying this in the full knowledge that everyone will be sort of horrified, drivers creating accidents and all the rest of it, that you have to intimidate everyone. you're not coming past me. You know, I know, you know, the greats have all done that. Some do it rather more elegantly than others. You know, Max, for example, can be a bit brutal. But the reality is, if you're going to be top of the pie, you need everyone behind you to know that they're not going to be coming past you easily. You are not going to move over. The reason why I said that I was appalled is I look at all of this through the prism of, you know, sitting in a management meeting, sitting in on a board meeting, you know, where you have the constructor's title and all of the prize money that comes with that. Let's remember, benefits not only the whole organization and every employee, but everyone associated with your company, all the sponsors, all the partners, all the suppliers, you know, winning that Constructors Championship or finishing high, as high up as you can in that Constructors Championship is so critical from a business point of view. And then you get to the Drivers' Championship and all the kudos that comes with that. You know, the difference it makes whenever you can talk about, you know, the Drivers' Championship and particularly if you're in a fortunate position to battle for that position. And to then have a scenario where all of those stakeholders, all your employees, your fans, you know, your partners, your sponsors, your shareholders, all of the people are all watching the race on TV and your drivers are tripping over each other. It's like, come on, guys. Where's the team? Where's the teamwork? Why haven't we sat down at 10 o'clock in the morning and said, this is what's going to happen? You're on pole position. You're a second into the first corner. X, Y, Z is going to happen. And you know, when I heard about papaya rules, by the way, I don't know what papaya rules are, but when I heard about papaya rules, I just did a massive eye roll. It was like, what the hell? You know, we don't need papaya rules. We just need a very simple discussion about the fact that we're here to finish first and second. There is a pecking order. The pecking order is not because we love one driver more than the other. The pecking order is because we want to win both championships. And let's be clear that at the present time, mathematically, one driver has a clearer shout. And I mean, I read yesterday online a couple of friends of mine who are Australian journalists talking about the fact that, you know, Piastri has a mathematical chance. You know, he could do it. You know, he could overtake Lando, and he could also beat Mac. Yeah, that isn't undoubtedly, you know, a possibility. It's not a very high probability that he's going to win the Drivers' Championship from where he is. It's not a very high probability. It's quite a high probability that he and Lando will keep taking so many points off each other that they let Max win the Drivers' Championship, particularly if Red Bull can find a cure for their current malaise. So it's, really interesting to see all of this unfold. But this is why it's great fun, Alex, whenever you manage to exercise a team principal like Andrea, and, you know, the media can sometimes say the unsayable. That's part of, you know, the media's responsibility. It's to question, it's to interrogate, it's to say the unsayable sometimes and provoke a response, and long may I continue.
Absolutely. But Mark, I wanted to just go back to one element of what you said about Piastri's character. And he just has the killer instinct. He has it already. Yeah. And I'm actually, having complimented you, I'm now going to upset you and Codders by revealing that, basically, to the listeners, we were supposed to record this podcast on the Wednesday before Monza when I arrived, but due to total laptop issues, the Wi-Fi not working, I wasted everybody's time for half an hour and we failed to record it. So we're now recording it post-race. But I did get everything working enough that yesterday on Monday after the Italian Grand Prix, I then went and recorded a different podcast. So that did eventually happen. It was possible to have done it, but it did get done. Anyway, on that podcast, we talked about exactly this. Oscar Piastri just has it. He has that ruthlessness that the world champions have. And I honestly, considering this is only his second year and how close he is to Lando Norris. Yeah. And if things had gone a different way, like look back at Miami, big points lost there on a weekend where he was brilliant and Lando Norris ended up winning, just from 100% swings of fortune. And Andrea Stella also said something really interesting post-race about, because of course he has experience of this from his career. he worked at Ferrari. He was Michael Schumacher's performance engineer. I don't actually know if the years align for Austria 01 and 02 and the team orders for Ferrari there. But he worked with Michael, had experience of seeing how he operated, and he was Fernando Alonso's race engineer during the Fernando is faster than you German Grand Prix in 2010. He knows exactly what can happen with team orders, whether they're applied or whether they're not. And he said, well, actually, there's a different situation because the successful driver, he didn't name them, but you know, you could apply this to either Schumacher or Alonso, they made the team orders thing almost automatic by just being better or by forcing the issue. And Lando Norris, I mean, it's to his credit in a way that he said in the press conference after the race, look, I'm not here to beg for anyone to give me a position. That's not what I'm about. Fair enough. But you could imagine if Fernando Alonso had been in Lando Norris's McLaren on Sunday and on the last lap of the race when it was obvious that Piastri was not going to catch Leclerc, Alonso would have been on the radio going, right, Parabolica, swap the cars. I have to get the points in the championship. He would have been demanding that on the radio. And that probably, it could be those little things that turn a championship. The reason why McLaren didn't do that was because there was such a risk, and this is why Leclerc's drive was so impressive, was because of the graining factor and how awful it was for the tyres interacting with that new tarmac. During FP2, if you got it slightly wrong and you locked up, you were gone. Like there was, it was just there. Was, you lose 10 seconds rather than just, you know, have a slight lock up and have to go off or whatever. So that's what they really wanted. That's what they were really fearing at all teams, and that's what McLaren was hoping, that if they just said right or didn't say anything, just let Piastri pressure Leclerc to the end, he might just make a mistake and they could still nick the victory back. But yeah, from Norris's point of view, it is interesting to think that he's not far enough ahead to get automatic team orders preference when, you know, enough of the season has gone on. And he doesn't have it within him to be ruthless enough to demand it in public. Like he kind of had the opportunity in Hungary and didn't take it. It's really interesting. You know, you can look at it two ways. You can look at it and say, look, he would have lucked into the Hungary thing, or you can, and you know, it's bad that he held on to that, or it's good that he showed the ruthlessness. So there's lots of ways of looking at it, but it is interesting to see, you know, the cliche that nice guys finish last is there for a reason.
The Jeff Wyler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall. With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Wyler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
I think Piastri, after the Hungarian Grand Prix, should have had a T-shirt made up saying, I won a Grand Prix and all I got was some lousy, grudging admiration.
100%. But what is interesting is I was there in that press conference in Hungary and I've sort of been doing one-off races. And I wasn't there in Zandvoort, so I can't comment on this. But in every press conference I've been in where the two McLaren drivers are there, they are totally miserable, considering they've got F1's best car. There's always something, whether it's they don't like the questions about are you in the title because it comes up so often, they don't want to get carried away with themselves, or something's gone wrong in a race where they've done really well. Like Hungary, it's Piastri's first win. And it wasn't like Norris in Miami where it was just pure joy. It was, this doesn't feel good, because he won a race in circumstances that no driver would ever choose to, as good as he was that day.
Yeah, it was a little awkward. Moving on, long-standing GP racing readers may recall a 2003 cover featuring Kimi Raikkonen and Fernando Alonso, remember him, saying, welcome to the future of F1. This month we say that again with a package looking at Andrea Kimi Antonelli and Oliver Behrmann, another feature a while in the making. Now, with Behrmann, we were hardly sticking our neck out because he has Ferrari backing and an F1 seat with Haas next year. And he's clearly being evaluated as a post-Hamilton possibility at the team. Some pundits still curiously pronounce as the Scuderia. Antonelli, interesting case. As we reveal in this month's issue, the direction of travel from the beginning of this year has been very much to get him ready for it. And yet we've had this very long wait for the announcement. And despite the press blackout Mercedes has maintained around him, one of our colleagues, Roberto Quincaro, has spoken to Antonelli and watched him test an F1 car. All those insights are in the feature. So the question, I suppose, is, and I suppose Alex, take this first, do we think that the reason for this long wait is that Toto's been waiting for Max to potentially become available given the Red Bull horror show?
Absolutely, 100%. I think, I mean, he said it at Monza in the press conference that this was his preferred plan to promote Antonelli, and it had come into his head 5 minutes after Lewis Hamilton told he was off for Ferrari. And it was always talked about, even at the time, that because he openly admitted that the reason why Hamilton ended up going to Ferrari is that he was given a 1+1 contract. He didn't get the love and sort of respect he felt he deserved. And because the reason was that Wolf wanted to leave his options open to say, right, I've got this kid that everyone says is the next Verstappen. I can promote him if things are going well. And maybe Lewis never gets back to the highs of the previous championships. And Lewis kind of went, okay. And then the Ferrari offer comes in or however it goes down, and he decides to take it. So Wolf sort of created the situation. And then obviously when the Red Bull management war happened, there's another opportunity because he doesn't have to promote Antonelli. They don't care what happens in the junior formula. If you impress enough as a proper youngster in karting and in the early titles, when you get to F2 and F3, it really undermines the categories. Like it almost seems to be no point to them because you've got drivers like winning F3 titles at the weekend who are never going to get to Formula One because they're not on the radar of the teams. Like I find it fascinating. But what Wolf was doing definitely was seeing if there was any opportunity with Max. And then also at the same time, you massively undermine and make it more tricky for your rivals by constantly courting him. And there's been so many elements of the year where I think that's come up. Like, for example, when Verstappen and Norris collided in Austria and Andrea Stella straight after the race was just like, this is outrageous. It's because he's not learned since 2021. That puts Toto Wolff in it's, oh, I know, there's very different things and I couldn't possibly comment. And the obvious reason is that he doesn't want to piss off Max Verstappen, who he might have in one of his cars. And it's interesting that line has held. Now we know that obviously it's going to be George Russell and Antonelli next year, but there was no mention of a contract length. Only 2025 was discussed because, again, this whole Max Verstappen, will he leave Red Bull thing is going to keep going until either he stays or he goes, or he sees out his contract or he doesn't. And one of those drivers, it was, you know, one of those Mercedes juniors that have spent years getting to this point is going to be jettisoned. That's clearly what's going to happen. And if I was George Russell, and Cotters, we can again, we'll give the listeners a little insight. We've gone into that in the next issue of GP Racing.
Yeah, and which we'll be talking about in just a couple of weeks.
Excellent. Yeah, no, much, much shorter interregnum this time. Charles II will be returning very fast. Anyway, I've gone down a total rabbit hole. But effectively, what Russell has to do is completely destroy Antonelli. He has to outqualify him every weekend. He has to outrace him. He has to make the case that I am undroppable if Max Verstappen becomes available. So it's a really interesting period that we've got at Mercedes. And you know, I was there at the weekend. The Italian fans absolutely. Already really excited about Antonelli. The track commentators, when he went fastest on his first lap, I mean, we were walking past the speaker, so it's pretty loud anyway, but it was like extra loud and blowing your ears out sort of vibe. A little bit quieter after he crashed on the next lap, let's put it that way.
Too fast for the car.
Yeah.
So they claim. I mean, surely a proper top level driver would have gone, hang on a minute, let's not do this and end up in the barriers. And what's interesting is that was the hottest session of the weekend up into the race, and you didn't see anybody else going off. Franco Colapinto managed to do it, but anyway, that's how Mercedes are spinning it.
Yeah. Would Barry Van Dijk have done the same if he'd ended up in the car? Because there's been a few people. Sorry, I went off on a tandem.
You've gone off on a we need more editorial notes for all the little segues to go with this. Alex, I couldn't agree more with you. It's a fascinating period. Incidentally, when Antonelli had his shunt, I had a WhatsApp message from a friend of mine who used to work at Red Bull saying he was amused that his name is Andrea Kimi, because he said on one lap he was Kimi Räikkönen and on the next lap he was Andrea De Cesaris. So it was, which I thought was quite amusing. But anyway, I'm going to start with the final point that you made about George Russell and Kimi arriving alongside him. I couldn't agree more with you. And actually, it goes back to some of the earlier podcast conversation about being ruthless. I think we could have a podcast on its own talking about George and Lewis as teammates at Mercedes and what has come out of that so far. But then looking forward to Antonelli lining up against George, I'm 100% with you. George has to destroy Antonelli. And I know it seems like an easy thing to say, well, why shouldn't he destroy him? You know, he's got all the experience, etc. But, you know, this is a kind of chips down moment. George needs to really hope that Antonelli is not as good as some people are saying, because if Antonelli comes in and does the opposite, if he destroys George next year, I mean, that's just cataclysmic for George. So, you know, the teammate rivalry thing again is it should be alive and well in every single team, and there's no cozying, you know, buddy-buddy relationships amongst teammates. There shouldn't be. This is war. Yes, you're both there to get the best out of the car that the team gives the two of you. But the only reason there are teammates in Formula One is that it's a rule. There's a regulation. You have to have two of them. Given the choice of the drivers, a lot of the drivers over the years wouldn't have had a teammate at any point. So I think the It's been a very interesting phase. You know, we're here recording this podcast, and when we reflect, you know, going back 9 months ago, no one saw Lewis Hamilton going to Ferrari coming over the horizon. No one saw Adrian Newey leaving Red Bull Racing and all of the issues that have materialized at Red Bull. No, you know, the Jos Verstappen, Christian Horner, spat, whatever that is. I'm not interested in anything that Jos particularly has to say. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, it's been a very, very unusual year. And then this surge, resurgence by McLaren, which has now become the big, you know, the big talking point. And that's something that, you know, was work in progress last year and then has continued in full force this year. So we're in a sport that seems to be going through so much flux in terms of relationships, teams, structures, performance. And you can understand why Toto Wolff, the moment he sensed that there might be an opportunity to get Max, well, that's going to become the play that Toto's going to try and make. And he has held out for as long as he possibly could. It'll be interesting to see what happens next now with Max, because you have to believe that if Red Bull continue to decline in performance, if they slide away from their position of dominance, and if that is going to become a permanent feature, Max will have no interest in sticking around. And of course, we know all about the political factions that there are, you know, within Red Bull, Dr. Marco and so on. So, you know, there's so much still to play for. So out of all of that kind of hedging his bets, making the play for Max, you know, obviously Toto, you know, finally has come to the conclusion, no point in waiting any longer. And Antonelli's exciting. Thing that I find extraordinary, when, you know, we talk about someone like Antonelli, you go online, you start looking at his career. You know, he's 18 years of age, and I mean, he's still relatively fresh out of karting, you know. But the thing that also impressed me about him is that, you know, he's now in Formula One, but despite having so few years of car racing, just how many car races he's done in an incredibly short time. I think one of his seasons, I think 2 years ago, he did did over 40 races in the year. Similarly, last year did something about the same. He did over 80 motor races in a sort of a 2-year period. So, you know, they signed them up young, but my goodness, these guys also build up the experience very quickly because they end up in multiple championships and, you know, racing pretty well every weekend. And I mean, clearly he's a guy that's exciting stuff, and great to see the, you know, what you witnessed, Alex, in terms of the fervour that there is in Italy, you know, for him, and what we saw at the weekend.
Yeah, it's interesting. He comes across rather well, actually. He doesn't come across as an 18-year-old. He's got that bedrock of confidence already, and yeah, it's nice to see that. The only sort of warning I've got around that is that I thought exactly the same about Logan Sargeant, and that very quickly disappeared. Not saying that's going to happen
like with
Antonelli, but it's interesting, isn't it? Because if things don't go his way, and if Russell is completely on top of him, or let's say he keeps shunting, because that is a very realistic possibility. I somewhat suspect that Antonelli is very, very fast, but is he too raw? Is Mercedes in for a real challenging year next year where he's absolutely rapid, but he crashes a lot? I could totally see it. And it's interesting already, you know, I sort of interpreted it as a little bit of a dig maybe from George. I could be wrong on this, but in the press conference after qualifying, he goes, yeah, I was on the back foot from the shunt that Antonelli had in my car in FP1, and we're all right on the edge now when it comes to available spare parts of their new updates. And they, you know, they're limited in what they can do in the cost cap, and they can't really afford to have a driver constantly crashing a car. I mean, Mick Schumacher's career ended because of that. So yeah, we love to talk about the narratives in Formula One right now, and this has provided another one, and one that will go on into next season.
Yeah, the nattering nabobs of the internet like to go on about Gilles Villeneuve making his debut with McLaren at Silverstone back in the 1970s, and how he, you know, went off at every corner while he was learning the limit, and that did him no harm. And, you know, as if, you know, rum, sodomy in the lash and capital punishment never hurt anyone, and toughened us all up, you snowflakes. The fact is, you know, the world, the Formula One world, is very different nowadays. If you go off, it incurs a cost, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And also that he wouldn't have had every fool with a Twitter account slagging him off, and probably him seeing it and it affecting his confidence. The comparison, I understand it, but I don't think it's particularly relevant, because everything is analysed in such micro detail now that can become a problem if a driver loses confidence. The one real strength for Antonelli is his relationship with Toto Wolff. I think if Toto Wolff backs you and likes you, you're going to go far, as long as you deliver for him. And if there are problems in the road, he'll make things happen. He'll make things happen to try and sort them out.
Yeah, and he won't get back to the garage and find Barry Van Dyke there.
My wife doesn't do a lot of Formula One analysis, but she did sort of her ears perked up at the news and at the weekend, and she said to me, "Did Antonelli crash at the same place as the safety car?" And I thought that was quite an interesting neutral observer's perspective on what happened. So I suppose if the safety car can crash there, I think we can forgive Antonelli. So
that was the one of the most unexpected things I've seen happen on an F1 Thursday, when they're all doing their media stuff and they test all the systems, like all the TV cameras, all the timing systems, and they do it with the safety car and the medical car. We looked up and the safety car was in the barriers at Parabolica. It's like, what on earth is going on? Red flags. They tested the red flag system anyway.
Because you kind of ignore it. If you see the red flag thing going out the corner of your eye, you usually ignore it because you think, oh, they're just testing the system. And then you probably just sort of looked at the monitor and went, actually, you know, what is all that sort of dust and whatnot with a green shape and a confused-looking burnt Maylander going, well, I don't know what happened there. Anyway, we've touched on Franco Colapinto, who, of course, not Barry Van Dyke, replaced Logan Sargeant last weekend. Though he obviously won't be in the Williams next year because they have two drivers signed. Alpine confirmed Jack Doohan as the occupant of their spare seat. He'll partner Pierre Gasly next year. And kind of a very different story from Antonelli. He's done some testing of previous cars stuff, but he's taken a year out. He's been, you know, the FKW on the pit wall and the sim jockey, and he's kind of gambled on getting that. So it's been a bit of a sweaty ride this year for Jack Doohan. And as it happened, some people might take this sentence the wrong way. He beat off Mick Schumacher for the role, and which of course Williams turned down Mick Schumacher as well. So who'd want to be a Mick Schumacher these days? Obviously Ralph Schumacher has a different point of view. Will we ever see Mick Schumacher in an F1 car again, do we think?
I can't see it, Codders. I think James Vowell's got himself into a bit of trouble with his comments, but his comments were completely correct in saying Mickey's good, but he's not special. I mean, it's true. Like, it's completely accurate. There's reports that Mick's mum had a go at James Vowell's as a result of that, and you know, he did this apology on F1 TV, and fair play to him for doing that, but. Yeah, it was sort of a bit like, oh no, they've reported that thing I said. Like, it's just like, you did say it, James. But also, he's not wrong. Like, I think that there's got to be a certain level of acceptance here that, yeah, Mick was, he was a decent Formula One driver. He was okay. He crashed too much, and you can't do that in a cost cap era, and the baggage that came with, you know, the pressure and the management and the expectations, you know, unfortunately, it just didn't work out. But it was interesting being there last weekend and watching Franco Colapinto's debut. I went, you know, sort of, I deliberately went to his press conference on Thursday and then bumped into him accidentally several times after that. But he kind of provided a nice picture of his debut weekend in that his press conference was packed. I mean, it was outside in the TV pen tent that they sort of use now, and it was absolutely roasting in Italy last weekend, or in that bit of Lombardy anyway. And you know, it was really intense. And I thought he handled it with aplomb. There was a little bit of, I noticed his hands were shaking at one stage, and you sort of realise again, these are really young people just trying to do their best in very complex situations. But I thought his answers were fine. Performed admirably, you know, in the race, considering he's had no practice. Drew Valtteri Bottas his ire for not being quick enough on the outlap, or no, sorry, on the laps of the grid, the formation lap. I mean, perhaps Valtteri, if you'd been in a quicker car and had been sitting up the front end of the grid, you wouldn't have minded so much. But whatever, that's a Sauber problem, not a Colapinto problem. But yeah, the other times I saw Colapinto was leaving the track after qualifying. We were leaving, or was it Friday night? It was one of the nights anyway. It was fairly late and we were coming out, and he was just ahead of us. And at the Monza paddock, once you go out of the swipe gates, there were some fans lining the route on the way to the car park when he was walking past. And he got sort of halfway down and suddenly someone goes, Franco! And then they all realised who he was. So he's not quite at the level of instant fame amongst the fans yet, but some very lucky people got autographs and selfies, and he was very graceful and very gracious with them. And then on Saturday night for Autosport, we do sort of a video we're allowed to film for 10 minutes in the paddock under the agreements, the media rights and waivers and things like that you have to adhere to. And I was there with MMB, who I mentioned earlier, Mark Man Bryans, and we were recording our video. And at one point, I was aware of sort of a woman moving a chair behind us, and I just didn't think anything of it, and turned around and realised it was Franco Colapinto with two people who, I don't know, they may have been his parents, they may not have been, but he was sat there signing Argentina football shirts. So I just thought that was a nice little detail, just doing that in the paddock at the end of the day. And I thought it performed very well at the weekend.
Yeah, great to see these guys come in. We were talking with Antonelli a few moments ago, being 18. I mean, Jack and Franco both only 21 years of age, and somehow that just suddenly feels a whole new level of experience just because they've got those extra few years behind them. I think it's such a great story about Jack Doohan. I remember watching him right at the beginning of his career when he came into Formula 4. I think he competed in Britain and in the ADAC series, etc. And just wondering, you know, is Mick's son, you know, gonna make it? And he's come through, and it's a very exciting opportunity for him getting in that Alpine drive. And then the Colapinto thing, I mean, it is, on the one hand, it's kind of unfortunate Williams are already sorted in terms of next year, but I agree with you, Alex. I thought he did a great job. I was watching his sort of lap times building through through the weekend, and just sort of looking at how consistent he was, and then beginning to imagine, you know, all the things that must be going through your mind when you, you know, you get that call up, and suddenly, you know, suddenly you got the thing that you've been dreaming about, and then you have to go out there and perform in front of the full world scrutiny. So, you know, great to hear that, you know, he's got his feet in the ground, not perhaps quite expecting the sudden fame. I mean, I think, again, great to have an Argentine driver come in. I'm personally always a big fan of seeing other nationalities come in, and at the risk of upsetting people, you know, there are so many British drivers that come in and through Formula One. There are a number of other nationalities that tend to be, you know, making a regular appearance in Formula One. I think for a world championship, it's great to see drivers from countries that are typically less well represented. We know there's such a huge fan base for Formula One in South America, full stop. And having been fortunate enough to work at the Grand Prix in Buenos Aires all those years ago, and then I've been back to the country a number of times since, you know, there's a legacy of Formula One within Argentina that's incredibly strong. And you can see why. You can imagine why Franco might be signing some Argentine football shirts. The country would really be getting behind him and hoping that this is the beginning of a new chapter for Argentina in Formula One.
Yeah, LATAM is quite underrepresented at the moment, isn't it, comparatively? When you think we're about to have, you know, half the grid is about to be Australian, and we have a Mexican driver sliding towards the off-ramp. We don't have a Brazilian on the grid. It's amazing to think that, you know, such a proud motor racing heritage Brazil has, and you know, we don't have a Brazilian mega doing the business at the moment. So that is highly peculiar. Who knows? Well, it's time to wrap this up because I hear that Captain Pugwash has to disembark his boat and get on a train. And hold on a minute.
I'm not sure that I'm enjoying this moniker of Captain Pugwash, but anyway, I'll take it for what it is.
Excuse me a moment, my phone's ringing. Hold on a second. Hello? Oh, hello, Jackie. Oh, really? Well, yes, I know. Yes, I'll tell them. Oh, thank you. Yes, okay, thank you. Lovely to speak to you. Thanks, bye. Jackie Stewart on the phone there. He wants to tell you, Mark, that all the drivers were bezzy mates in the 1960s. He used to hang around by the pool together. There's none of this killer instinct. And, you know, if you want him, he's now going to double his rates if you want him at one of your speaking engagements.
Yeah. Okay, thank you for that.
There we go. It's so nice of Sir Jackie Stewart to phone the podcast live. Anyway,
I was completely sold on the bit, by the way. I genuinely thought you were answering the phone and we had to wait to re-record it at the end. Oh, it's a delivery downstairs or something. Brilliant.
So someone did knock, but it could have been the Jehovah's Witnesses. I mean, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, who on earth is knocking on my door? Anyway, where are we at? Yeah, it's the end of the podcast for this time. We'll be back in a couple of weeks because we're partway through an issue cycle. For all the latest offers and stuff, go to gpracing.com. If you prefer to enter an actual retail establishment and support your local high street, make sure your journey isn't wasted. Visit seymour.co.uk if you're living in the UK. Type your postcode into the store finder to locate your nearest stockist. That's Seymour, spelled as in the original name of the band Blur. Fact. Alex is astounded. That hasn't gone over your head, has it? Anyway, thanks for listening. This has been a Motorsport Network production. The producer was Dre Harrison.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.